A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
What do you do when the most compassionate, evidence-based advice about someone you love is to leave them, and that advice effectively condemns them to a life of isolation? That's the question Daniel sent us. And honestly, I've been turning it over in my head since I read it.
It's the kind of question that sits in your stomach, not your head. You can feel it.
Here's the core of what he's wrestling with. We've talked before about personality disorders as egosyntonic conditions. The person's traits feel like who they are, not a problem to fix. That insight helps explain why reasoning with them fails. But Daniel's pushing us further. He's pointing at the neuroscience. We now have fMRI evidence that these conditions involve real, measurable brain differences. Reduced prefrontal volume, amygdala abnormalities, structural changes you can see on a scan. These aren't choices. They're not moral failings. And yet, the harm they produce is just as real as if they were.
The treatment landscape. I've been reading the latest research, and it is sobering. For borderline personality disorder, DBT helps maybe half of patients, and only about 30% maintain that improvement 5 years out. For antisocial personality disorder, the effect sizes are negligible. For narcissistic, we barely have randomized controlled trials at all. So we have a condition that's neurobiologically grounded, largely resistant to treatment, and the best advice we can give people in its path is, protect yourself. Leave if you have to.
Which means we're doing triage. And triage means someone gets left behind. Daniel called this one of the great tragedies of the human condition, and I don't think that's an overstatement. So that's what we're going to sit with today. The paradox of understanding without a solution, neuroscience without effective treatment, and the question of whether there's any way forward that doesn't abandon either the person with the disorder or the people they hurt.
Let's start with what the science actually shows us about the brain in personality disorders, because the answer is more complicated than either side of this debate wants to admit. Before we get into the brain scans, I want to pull on the thread Daniel's prompt exposed, because it's not the standard, mental illness isn't a choice, conversation. We've all heard that one. This is something sharper.
The standard version goes, they can't help it, so be patient. It's a call for empathy that assumes empathy leads somewhere, to treatment, to improvement, to some kind of resolution. Daniel's pointing at a scenario where empathy doesn't lead anywhere. You understand the neuroscience, you accept the person isn't choosing this, and you're still left with harm that doesn't stop. That's the crisis.
It's ethical before it's clinical. If personality disorders are egosyntonic, and we establish that matters because it means the person experiences their traits as identity, not illness, then the very thing that makes treatment possible, recognizing something is wrong, is precisely what's impaired. You can't reason someone out of a condition that feels like reasoning to them.
The neuroscience lands differently here than it does with, say, depression. With depression, showing someone a brain scan that says, this isn't your fault, can be liberating. It externalizes the problem. With a personality disorder, the scan says, this isn't your fault, but the condition is woven into the structure of who they are. There's no them, separate from it, to do the liberating.
That's exactly the distinction. And it's why the usual moral calculus breaks. Normally, if harm isn't intentional, we assign less blame. But when the harm is patterned, predictable, and resistant to intervention, the fact that it's unintentional doesn't make it less destructive. We end up in this strange position where nobody is to blame, and yet the damage is real and ongoing.
Which is where Daniel's religious unease comes in. If you believe in a just or meaningful universe, the existence of people who seem hardwired to cause suffering and unreachable by any tool we have, that's not just a clinical problem. It's a theodicy problem. Why would a benevolent creator design people who are condemned to isolation and condemn everyone around them to either absorb harm or walk away?
I don't think we can solve that one in 25 minutes.
No, but we can name it honestly. And I think that's part of what Daniel's asking for. Not a solution, but permission to call it what it is. Not a failure of compassion, not a failure of the mental health system specifically, though that system has certainly failed, a genuine, irreducible tragedy of the human condition.
The reason I want to sit with that before we dive into the research is that the research itself can feel like it's making an argument. Look, brain scans, it's not their fault. And then the unspoken conclusion is supposed to be, so you should stay and tolerate it. But that doesn't follow. The neuroscience describes what's happening. It doesn't prescribe what you owe.
That's the paradox we're going to trace through the rest of this. The brain data is real. The treatment limitations are real. The harm is real. And holding all three of those truths at once, without letting any of them cancel out the others, that's the actual challenge. Not picking a side, but refusing to pretend the tension doesn't exist.
Let's ground this in the actual scans. The 2024 meta-analysis from Frontiers in Psychiatry pooled data across Cluster B personality disorders, that's borderline, antisocial, narcissistic, histrionic, and found reduced gray matter volume in prefrontal and temporal regions, with effect sizes in the moderate range, Cohen's D of about 0.4 to 0.6.
Which means what, in plain terms?
It means these are real structural differences, not subtle ones. The prefrontal cortex is your brain's regulation hub. Impulse control, emotional modulation, the ability to pause between feeling and action. When there's less gray matter there, that circuitry is literally thinner. And then you look at the amygdala, the threat detection system, and it depends on which disorder. In borderline personality disorder, the amygdala is hyperreactive. It's firing too hot, too fast. In antisocial personality disorder, it's the opposite. Reduced volume, about 10 to 15% smaller than controls, and blunted reactivity, especially to fear cues.
One group is drowning in emotional intensity, and the other barely registers it. Same cluster of disorders, opposite neuroprofiles.
That's why lumping them together as personality disorders can be misleading. But the common thread is that the systems that regulate emotion and social behavior are structurally and functionally different from typical brains. These are not choices. You can see them on a scan.
Which brings us back to egosyntonic. If your amygdala is calibrated completely differently, the behaviors that result feel internally consistent. The person with borderline isn't choosing to have emotional storms. That's their baseline. The person with antisocial isn't choosing not to feel fear. Their hardware doesn't generate it the same way.
And that's what makes treatment so difficult. You're not just modifying behavior, you're trying to work against a brain architecture that was shaped over decades of development. The neural pathways are entrenched.
Where does that leave us on treatment? You mentioned DBT numbers earlier.
Dialectical behavior therapy is the gold standard for borderline, and it's genuinely better than nothing, meaningful improvement in about 50% of patients over 1 to 2 years. But here's the number that stuck with me. The 2025 longitudinal study for BMC psychiatry followed DBT completers for 5 years. Only 30% maintained clinically significant improvement.
So, 7 out of 10 people who went through the best treatment we have were back where they started within 5 years.
That's the people who finished. Dropout rates range from 25 to 40% across studies, higher when there's comorbid substance use or greater symptom severity. So you're already selecting for the people most likely to benefit.
What about the other cluster B disorders?
For antisocial personality disorder, the analyses are bleak. Some show negligible effect sizes. Treatments barely outperform no treatment at all. For narcissistic personality disorder, we don't even have proper randomized controlled trials. The evidence base is essentially missing.
For the two conditions that arguably cause the most harm to others, we have almost nothing that works.
There's a darker wrinkle. Some studies suggest that poorly delivered therapy can make things worse, iatrogenic harm. If a therapist gets drawn into the patient's relational patterns, validates the wrong things, or if group therapy creates a space where antisocial individuals reinforce each other's norms, you can actually deepen the pathology.
Just get them into treatment isn't just naive. It might be actively dangerous in the wrong circumstances.
Which complicates the entire ethical picture. We're not saying there's help available, but they won't take it. We're saying the help itself is limited, hard to access, often ineffective, and sometimes counterproductive. That's the landscape Daniel's prompt is pointing at. And it's why the triage metaphor you used earlier lands so hard. We're not withholding a cure, The cure doesn't exist.
We have this picture. Neurobiologically real. Largely egosyntonic. Stubbornly resistant to treatment. And that brings us to the question Daniel is actually asking. What do we do with that knowledge? Because the most rational advice, set boundaries, limit contact, leave. That's triage. And triage means someone gets left behind.
That word, left behind, is the part that keeps people up at night. Daniel described it perfectly. The inner voice that says it's unfair to blame them. And that voice isn't wrong. The person didn't choose their amygdala structure. But the voice that says, therefore I should stay and absorb this, that's not a logical conclusion. It's guilt dressed up as ethics.
It's more than guilt, I think. It's moral injury. You're caught between two genuine obligations. Compassion for someone who's suffering, and protection of yourself and others. And the world is telling you that you have to violate one of them. There's no clean path.
Which is why I've come to think about this in terms of what I'd call compassionate distance. It's the idea that you can hold two truths that feel contradictory. One, this person is suffering from a real neurological condition they did not choose. Two, you are not obligated to absorb the harm that condition produces. Compassion does not require proximity.
That's a hard sell for a lot of people, especially if they come from a religious tradition that emphasizes forgiveness and bearing one another's burdens. Daniel raised the spiritual dimension directly. If you believe in a benevolent creator, why would people be hardwired into this impossible situation?
I've thought about this a lot, and I don't think the question has a satisfying answer at the level of explanation. But maybe the spiritual challenge isn't to explain why such people exist. Maybe it's to recognize that our response to them, the willingness to hold both genuine empathy and clear self-protection, is itself a moral act. You're not failing a test of compassion by setting boundaries. You're demonstrating that compassion can be wise rather than self-destructive.
There's a practical framework that actually exists for this. The DBT for Families model. Programs that teach family members concrete skills for interacting with a loved one who has borderline personality disorder without sacrificing their own well-being. There was a randomized controlled trial in 2023 that showed a 40% reduction in caregiver burden at 12-month follow-up, plus measurable improvements in family functioning.
40% is meaningful. It's not a cure for the person with the disorder, but it's a real intervention for the people around them. And it's built on a concept from DBT called radical acceptance, accepting that the person may never change and that your own safety and sanity are valid priorities. Not secondary priorities, not selfish ones.
The mental health system has not solved this, and Daniel's right to name that failure. Inpatient treatment is often contraindicated for personality disorders. It can reinforce the very patterns it's supposed to treat. Outpatient therapy is expensive, hard to access, and as we've seen, often ineffective. We've essentially told society, protect yourself, without providing adequate resources for either the afflicted or their families.
That's the systemic tragedy underneath the personal one. We're not just failing the people with the disorders. We're failing their partners, their children, their parents, their coworkers, everyone in the blast radius. And we're doing it while knowing more about the neuroscience than ever before. Knowledge without treatment is a particular kind of cruelty.
How do you set boundaries without becoming cruel or abandoning your own values? I think the answer starts with reframing what boundaries are. They're not punishment. They're not a moral judgment on the other person. They're a description of what you need to remain functional and whole. You can say, I care about you, and I cannot be in regular contact with you, and mean both halves of that sentence.
That sentence, I care about you, and I cannot be in regular contact with you, that's not a contradiction. It's two truths that belong next to each other. But I know from years of clinical practice that the person saying it often doesn't believe they're allowed to hold both.
Which brings us to the practical question. Given everything we've laid out, the neuroscience, the treatment limits, the moral weight, what can someone actually do if they're in this situation, not abstract principles?
The first thing is to take the understanding as protection framework seriously, but pair it with a hard commitment to your own boundaries. Understanding why someone behaves the way they do is a tool for emotional survival. It helps you stop taking it personally, it lets you see the pattern instead of just feeling the impact, but it is not a justification for absorbing harm.
The map is not an invitation to walk into the minefield. It's a tool for navigating around it.
And the second thing, this one gets overlooked constantly, is that if you're in a relationship with someone who has a personality disorder, you need support for yourself. Not couples therapy. Not family therapy with the person. Support that is exclusively yours.
The research backs this up. We mentioned the DBT for families trial and that 40% reduction in caregiver burden. But there's a broader point here. Caregiver burnout and secondary trauma in these situations are real and massively underaddressed. People end up managing someone else's emotional dysregulation for years and wondering why they're exhausted.
Organizations like NAMI and the Personality Disorder Awareness Network have resources specifically for family members and partners. Support groups, educational materials, skills training, and the simple act of being in a room with other people who get it, who don't look at you and say, "Why don't you just leave?" or "Why aren't you more patient?" That's therapeutic in itself.
There's a third thing, and it's the one I think Daniel was really reaching for. The inner voice that says setting boundaries is unfair, that you're perpetuating the cycle, that you're abandoning someone who can't help it. How do you answer that voice?
I've got a question I used to ask patients when they were stuck in that loop. What would you tell a close friend in your exact situation? Because we are almost always more compassionate toward others than toward ourselves. We'd tell the friend, "You've done enough, you're allowed to protect yourself, this isn't your fault." But we withhold that same permission from ourselves.
That reframe is deceptively powerful. It externalizes the judgment without externalizing the decision. You're not asking someone else to decide for you. You're just applying the standard you'd apply to anyone you love.
Here's the thing about that guilt. It often comes from a place of genuine moral seriousness. You're not a bad person for feeling it. You're a person who takes their obligations seriously. But obligation has limits, and those limits aren't a failure of character. They're a recognition that you are finite, that you can be broken, and that a broken you helps no one.
To pull these threads together, 1. Understanding is for protection, not permission. 2. Get your own support. The research says it works, and you're not meant to do this alone. 3. When the guilt hits, ask yourself what you'd tell a friend. Apply that same standard.
Underneath all of that, there's a larger permission we don't give people enough. You do not have to fix the system to be allowed to protect yourself. The tragedy of personality disorders is real and unresolved. Acknowledging that, without pretending there's a clean solution, is itself a form of integrity. You're not failing because you can't solve a problem the entire mental health field hasn't solved.
Daniel called this one of the great tragedies of the human condition. I think he's right. And the most honest thing we can say is that sitting with that tragedy, refusing to look away from it, and still choosing to protect your own life, that's not selfishness. That's clarity.
That clarity leads to the next question, the one we can't answer yet but have to ask. What would a mental health system that actually served these people look like? Not the one we have, which, as you said, basically amounts to triage and distance. Something built from scratch. Designed for conditions that are neurobiologically real and stubbornly resistant to everything we've tried.
I think the honest starting point is admitting that triage and distance isn't a system. It's a failure of imagination dressed up as policy. We've essentially told an entire category of suffering people, and that's what they are, suffering people, that the best we can offer is to help everyone else get away from them.
It's not just a failure of imagination, it's a resource failure, a training failure, or research failure. Most clinical psychology programs spend minimal time on personality disorders compared to depression and anxiety. Most therapists actively avoid these patients because they're difficult, because the work is slow, because the risk of getting drawn into destructive dynamics is real. So we have a treatment gap that starts at the training level and compounds from there.
If you were designing from scratch, and I know this is speculative, what changes?
Longer treatment horizons, for one. The idea that 12 or 16 sessions of anything will shift a personality structure that took decades to form is almost laughable. We'd need models that assume years, not weeks. We'd need therapists specifically trained and supervised for this work, with caseloads small enough that they don't burn out. We'd need family support built in from day one, not as an afterthought. And we'd need to fund research on the disorders where we currently have nothing, narcissistic, antisocial, instead of just studying borderline because it's the one where patients sometimes get better and thank you for it.
That last point stings because it's true. The research follows the hope.
It follows the fundable hope, and that leaves the most destructive disorders in the dark.
Here's the harder question, and I think it's where the neuroscience is eventually going to take us whether we're ready or not. As the brain imaging gets better, as we can identify these structural and functional differences earlier and more precisely, what do we do with that information?
You're talking about prediction, identifying children at risk before the personality structure solidifies.
If we can see the neural signatures emerging, reduce prefrontal volume, amygdala abnormalities, in a 12-year-old, do we intervene? And what does intervention even mean at that stage? We don't have treatments that work for fully formed adults. We certainly don't have validated preventive protocols for adolescents.
You open the door to a whole new set of ethical problems. Labeling a child as at risk for antisocial personality disorder based on a brain scan, the stigma alone could shape their entire trajectory. Teachers treat them differently. The legal system watches them differently. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Or it becomes the justification for interventions that look a lot like coercion. If we know the brain is developing toward a pattern that will cause harm, and we know the person won't recognize it as a problem because it's egosyntonic, then the logic of forced treatment starts to look reasonable. We'd be intervening on someone who hasn't done anything yet, based on a probability, for a condition they can't consent to treating, because the condition itself impairs the capacity to consent.
That's a dystopian road, and it's not hard to see how we end up on it. The neuroscience is real. The suffering is real. The desire to do something is real. But something can become something awful, very quickly if we're not careful.
We're caught between two failures. The present failure, where we abandon people to isolation because we have no tools, and a possible future failure, where we overcorrect into preemptive control and create a different kind of harm. Neither one honors the full humanity of the person with the disorder.
That's why Daniel's framing, one of the great tragedies of the human condition, lands the way it does. It's not hyperbole. It's not despair either. It's just an honest accounting of where we are. We have more knowledge than ever before. We can see the problem in the brain. We can name it precisely, and we still don't know what to do.
I keep coming back to something you said earlier, that we don't have to solve the tragedy to honor it. Sometimes the most honest thing we can do is sit with it and refuse to look away, not pretend there's a fix around the corner, not paper over the guilt with easy reassurance. Just say, this is real, this is hard, and if you're in it, you're not failing by protecting yourself.
If you found this conversation valuable, if it gave you a framework or just permission to name something you've been carrying, please rate the show and share it with someone who might need to hear it. This one's going to sit with me for a while.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll be back soon. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1810s, the rules of real tennis were codified to specify that a ball landing in the dedans, the netted gallery at the serving end, scores a point for the striker. An unintended consequence of which was that cork builders in colder climates began angling the dedans roof to prevent snow accumulation from warping the timber, a design quirk still visible in the sole surviving real tennis court in Nunavut.
I don't know what to do with that.
The dedans roof angle.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.